We have been stealing the future from our children.
Challenges of conservation and combating climate change are connected.
Corruption is being created by wildlife crime.
Speciesism is very much the same as racism or sexism.
We must rethink our relationship with wildlife, the environment, and each other. Join us as we uncover the innovative, unifying, and urgent solutions we need to protect the planet from ourselves. This is the Art of Conservation.
Oh, guys, I am freezing my ass off.
Really?
Yeah. Drove from Cape Town to the sanctuary. And yeah. I mean, for most of the drive, early hours of this morning, the outside temperature was probably 2 or 3 degrees. Getting freezing warnings in the car as I was driving. And the moment the sun dips here, it drops below 10 degrees Celsius. And at the moment, I don't think it's more than about 5 degrees. So, yeah, testing me. But wonderful to be here as ever. Munu is spectacular. The place is looking good. We've had good rains, so the camps are recovering. Munu will go into his new camp in the next couple of days.
Yeah.
I knew you'd be happy about that one, Shan. The guys have worked really, really hard to
clear
the fence lines and so on. So, yeah,
it's not negative apart from the issue you're dealing with.
Yes. I mean, there's always issues. I think you just, I'm starting to realize that running a sanctuary is kind of just playing whack-a-mole. You know, you're constantly a firefighter. But that's the job, you know. So you roll with it, you deal with it.
Learning.
Yeah, you know, that's the one thing that I'm really enjoying is every single day there's something new to learn. So as I was driving in today, there was this huge Inyala bull just standing in the middle of the road, and watching how it would maneuver itself to make sure that it was always between the car and its young, obviously with his missus and this tiny little baby. It's just too sweet.
But that's so cute.
It was beautiful. And just constantly maneuvering to make sure that it was always between me and the youngster.
Yeah.
And they sort of filtered off into one of the camps. Yeah. And it's beautiful to watch because between the Inyala, the bushbucks, and the kudu, they hang around in Munu's camps and around him throughout the day, throughout the evening. Drink from his mud wallow. It's wonderful to see sort of that natural life around Munu. Yeah.
Does he sense them there?
He definitely does. He doesn't really react to them. Every now and again, he'll sort of stop and he'll listen and he will motion in their direction as they move through the camp. So he's very aware that they're there. And of course, their droppings are all over the show. So he's acutely aware that they're there, but they don't, as it would be in the wild. It doesn't cause him any discomfort or concern at all, which is quite fun to watch, actually.
That's amazing. They're getting in to drink from his mud wallow.
Yeah, they just jump over.
That's so cool.
Yeah. I haven't seen them, but I've seen their spoor through his outdoor Burma area. So and there's only one way in, and that's over the top.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Nalu can, like Kudu, they can jump. And
this is a big boy. I think possibly the biggest Inyala bull I've ever seen.
They're so beautiful. They really are. I think they're the loveliest of the... Well, the bushback are very pretty too. They're more dainty. But the Inyala and the Inyala females are so gorgeous as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
But the men are so—they're lovely with their orange socks and their.
Yeah, no, they're very, very pretty animals. But jumping into it, guys. Last episode we spoke at length about the comparisons or the potential parallels between the South American vicuna wool trade and rhino horn trade. And I think I went back and I listened to the episode, and there was one thing that I didn't share in that, a definition, that I was rightly taken to task by several listeners. And that was my reference to farming vicuna. And I just want to be clear that the definition of sort of farming them is not in this overtly domesticated way that you would sort of see cows moving through a paddock. Vicuna are near impossible to domesticate, and they don't breed well in captivity. So what I mean by farming, what I mean meant by sort of intensive populations, is that the areas that are protected are within the sort of Andean range. So they're not in these paddocks, they're not in these camps as you would typically associate, but they are within very clearly defined and protected areas. And so not a farm in the traditional sense. And I very stupidly didn't read that one part of my notes as I was describing the trade to you guys and to our listeners. And I was rightly taken to task on that. So that's the clarification that I wanted to to put forward.
Okay, but there is, I mean, I can't recall it all now, Si, but I know that there's a very big distinction between the way that things are done. I think Argentina is the way where they are more closely farmed than, say, Bolivia and Chile and other places.
Correct.
Where it's more done on the, you know, they catch the wild ones, shear them, and let them go. And I suppose they do kill a few for meat and that sort of thing as well. But right. I have a feeling that the bigger part of the industry is dominated by a South American ranching mentality linked to the fur trade dominated by Italy.
That's 100% correct.
And so you end up with a sort of, what's it, not big farmer, but
well, it's big agriculture, but the distinction is that they're still in their natural habitat. They're not taken into a domesticated environment as much as they are farmed and captured and sheared and kept in very clearly defined areas. That is largely natural habitat for the most part. I can't find anything that draws a percentage-based distinction between those more intensive environments and otherwise.
I did see something. I'll try and find it again.
Yeah, if you could, because I know we've spoken about it. But with the references that I used, specifically being Peru and Bolivia, there is less of that highly, highly domesticated intention favoring more of these defined wild areas and increasing the population within those areas. So they do create a concentration of the population within those areas.
Yeah.
And those areas are typically by the more resourced sort of mega traders, if I can put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it doesn't remove my point. And this is what I wanted to get back to. Because even if we take the Bolivian example, and we just, and again, this is just Bolivia, I'm not talking to the rest, because we know that a one size, you know, fits all approach is not appropriate, nor is it accurate. But one of the documents that I was referencing was from CITES, who in 2019 did a study, and they said that, you know, Bolivia lifted their population during these sort of trade intentions from a few thousand to more than 150,000 between 1969 and 2018. But CITES themselves takes a look at the value that these trade enterprises, I'll refrain from calling them farms, but these trade enterprises and what they mean to the communities within those Andean regions. And in Bolivia, just to give you an idea of the drop-off in the community participation and the community reward, they've got a table that illustrates the volume of men and women and people involved in the trade. And in 2014, 10,833 men, 7,195 women, total 18,028 people, 3,005 families were directly involved in the trade and receiving value from it. In 2018, in 4 years, that number across the board effectively halved to 5,167 men, 4,275 women, a total of 9,442 people, and 1,574 families were involved. And this was during the period, partly during the period that we saw the 78% increase in the trade. So the community value is decreasing while the overall trade is increasing. So that immediately talks to that concentration of value not going broadly back to those communities, which was the initial intention of the trade and which underpinned the comments of many of those protagonists at the time, now saying that it was ill-informed and it was ill-structured and that the opening of the trade has not done what it said it what it set out to do.
Mm.
The other thing that I was taken to task on was that 3% goes back to those communities. And I said it in the last episode, but it's 3% of the total trade value. If we look at it on just the export value, so not the industry total from from animal to retail garment, if we look at that, the total value that comes out of the vicuña wool trade in export, so just to export, it's not retail manufacturing, 8% royalty payment to the government, 3% payment on tax on profits, 3% operational costs of marketing that sort of centralized trade operation, and 85% to benefit families and communities. So that is in the export trade. And you think, okay, well, that's a hell of a lot better. But that also goes to show my point, is that if 85% of the export value is going back to the communities, but that translates to 3% of the total trade value, in other words, the retail value of that same garment, you can see the massive disparity between where the value proposition lies in the trade on vicuña wool. It goes to the manufacturers and the brands who are retailing the garments. It does not filter proportionately back to those that are tasked with the protection and the harvesting of vicuña wool. So CITES themselves digs deeper into that, and they point out that of the community programs or of the trade operations, the CMVs as they call them, there were 15 of these entities operational in 2019. By 2013, six of those had fallen off, and by 2018, there are just three community run and managed operations that are actively contributing to that trade. The rest of them are sort of more ingrained in public-private partnerships, in those more intensive operations, again, not traditional domestic farming. So when CITES were then, in their own writing, said, what are the challenges facing the trade going forward? And they make a point that says that the trade itself has not gone to deliver effective value to these communities. And many of these communities, even though they're receiving a pittance of the trade value, are sometimes waiting in excess of a year to get their money. So they're experiencing all of those hard costs of protection, capturing, shearing, releasing, etc. And they are only getting the financial reward for those efforts more than a year later. So the motivation for those communities to continue with the practice when they don't have the cash flow from the very trade that has been designed to support them is leaving a huge problem. And that's why that's why they suggest that there is this significant drop off of community engagement and involvement in the program overall. And then they go on to say, you know, further challenges the program must tackle if it is to course correct itself is that these community-based organizations that are under the control of this sort of centralized buying operation need to be geared towards more commercial mainstream operations. They need to be invested in, they need to be better resourced and better educated on how to run these. Promoting a far more integrated management system across all of these these ecosystems, including wildlife and livestock management, because the soil degradation, the lack of ecological management of those areas where they do have the intensive populations is also leading to a problem. And above everything else, in the last few years, as we've seen this dip off of community value, there has been a resurgence in poaching. And the poaching increase has happened in the areas where these communities are being underserved by the very program that was designed to look after them. So in summary, my point still stands. It is not a fair comparison to say it worked for Vicuna because the populations are up. That is a one-dimensional argument. And if we look at the broader parallels and comparisons, more than ever, I believe that the Vicuna trade is not a sufficient comparison to motivate for the trade in rhino horn. So to everybody that reached out to me and had a go at me, take that.
So if I can just make one aside, seeing that I've interrupted it here.
No, that's cool. Don't worry about it.
I would say, you know, in your future dealings, you said earlier that you were wrong to XYZ. I don't think that you should say that. I think you should say that you acknowledge that the issue is perhaps more nuanced.
Well, I was wrong to not clarify the terms that I used. The information still stands. I've defined the terminology. I defined the language that I was using and appreciate that it could have been misleading if we just took it at a traditional explanation. I didn't go far enough in explaining that. So I'm happy to sort of correct on the definition to clear that up. But with that cleared up, I do believe that my points are still valid.
Absolutely.
So, Peter, you shared an interesting piece with me during the week, which I think is relevant to this. South African news stalwart, probably the best news outlet in the country, Daily Maverick, had an op-ed piece that started to talk more acutely to the need for us to move beyond just this trade, no trade idea with rhinos. And it does talk to the community angle, if I understood it correctly.
Yes, you're right. It was an interesting article. Interestingly, too, because it was written by someone who's a close neighbor of mine in Cape Town. She's a noted author, and she bumped into Major General Johan.
Johan Uster,
Sorry?
Major General Johan Huerster, yeah.
Yes. And they had a chat at the Literary Book Fair because he was there promoting his book on the Rhino Wars, etc. And that's how she got stuck into it. And she found, as she was discussing it with him and chatting to and getting to know him and the book better, she began to understand some of the bigger issues at stake as well.
Who was the author? Who wrote the piece?
The author is a lady by the name of Bridget Pitt.
Okay.
And the link is there for the readers afterwards.
Yeah.
But you know, it comes back into what I think is a very healthy thing, and that is because she acknowledges the poaching aspect. She can't not acknowledge that. But in talking to Buster, she understands, as we do, that we often talk about the Rhino War, and we often talk about, well, most of the poachers come from Mozambique. So there's an unfortunate assumption that maybe we're sort of at war with Mozambique, which is a very uncomfortable thing. But what she was pointing out was that because of the nature of the beast with poaching, that we're in fact dealing more with a civil war, a South African civil war, because there's this antipathy, antagonism within communities that have been excluded from conservation circles. On the other hand, there are people in those same communities that work in conservation and are dedicated people in terms of the protection of rhinos. So you've got this uncomfortable, really horrid boiling pot of stuff. And, you know, we talk about that and we know about it quite intimately. But I don't think for all the work that we do that the general public actually understands that as much. And what I find very healthy is that people not immediately involved with the conservation world, like Bridget Pitt, are giving time and mind to this problem.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very healthy thing. And I think the other thing that I would like to point out, and because, as you know, I am in the UK at the moment visiting family and friends. So, you know, I've been keeping an eye on the stories in the UK. Are there any interesting stories that have relevance for us in Africa? And, you know, immediately you get back to this community issue, that conservation falls down in terms of its relationship with communities. Now, the situation might be very different, but I mean, just listen to this and immediately you'll see why. But I read today that there's a plan in Cornwall, which is the southwestern part of the UK, of England, and there's a plan to turn the moorland there into a heavily protected nature conservation area, which has been approved despite warnings that it will wreck farming in the region, quote unquote. And there were calls of shame on you and resign as members of the Natural England Board voted to designate 59 blocks of land as a site of special scientific interest, arguing that this will preserve precious flora and fauna. So now you see in a relatively well-off, sophisticated country like the UK, the same thing's happening. Conservation moving ahead, and they don't bring the communities with them, and they have this massive kickback. Yeah, and, you know, the situation is not very different from ours in Africa. It's the same things, and I see, and you were talking earlier about the communities in South America and the vicuna trade. And again, you see this conflict between community and conservation. And, you know, more and more, I think people like us are realizing that probably that is, apart from legislation and funding and all those things that we know about, that some of the deepest troubling, difficult things to deal with are conservation being able to say, yes, we've got to change the way we work in the world, we've got to protect this land, we've got to invest in it, but we are not bringing communities along with us. And I'll give you another example. It's happened in Scotland, where the Scottish government has scrapped its plans to create a highly protected marine area, which was going to be about 10% of Scottish seas. The proposals would have restricted fishing and other human activities in a bid to protect the environment. But instead of everybody being fully with this, members of the Scottish fishing industry, coastal communities, have raised fierce objections to the concept. And they're saying it's going to be catastrophic, have a catastrophic impact on the fishing industry and therefore communities. And so it comes on. And the former finance secretary for Scotland says that people, not wildlife, could become the endangered species, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And even, I don't know them, but there's apparently a well-known Celtic music band called Skippinish. And they've written a song that, within the words of the song, warns that the soul will be torn from island communities with the protected areas representing a wrecking ball to our existence. So again, we see in well-developed countries, countries where, relatively speaking, there's far more finance going into conservation and activity, more wealth behind the movement, shall I say. But coming into those self-same conflicts with communities.
Jeepers. I mean, you're 100% right that it is it's a global conundrum, and it doesn't matter the country at all, really. And for me, I don't think that it's so much a conservation problem as much as conservation is the soft target and collateral damage in the standoff between sort of emancipation, economic emancipation of local and rural communities and big business. That, you know, if we look at the standoff that I know exists in Scotland as well, which is a standoff between the subsistence fisher folk and the industrialized fishing or fish farming, is also a conundrum. And conservation tends to be the whipping boy in the middle of it.
Well, that is true. I mean, you know, when people say, "Oh, well, there has to be some room for compromise," to my mind, it's nearly always the environment that gives rather than takes.
Yeah, 100%.
But it is a huge international problem, and I'm sure many of the people that listen to our podcasts understand that perfectly.
Yeah, I think they do.
But so. Yeah, it is something that we have to. Why are we talking about climate change, and why are we talking about global environmental funds and investment in conservation? We have to bear in mind that we have to get the proper social structures in place.
Totally.
And as you said, there is really no one size fits all anywhere in the world. But their commonality in the fact that communities and conservation are so often at odds with one another.
I totally agree. There was another thing that happened since we last recorded. Some time back at COP15, the GEF, the Global Environment Facility, has now followed through on what became known as the Kunming-Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework, which was set about to provide support and structure to achieving advances in biodiversity protection by 2030. Now, I initially wrote it off the same way I've largely written off so many of the other 30 by 30 and all of these ideologies that were just basically kicking the can down the road. you know, that we had all of these targets to achieve by 2030. And, you know, we're missing a lot of those, so we introduced new targets. But GEF has followed through on something. And this week they announced they've approved plans for a game-changing global biodiversity framework fund. The size of the fund, I don't know. But what it does is that the fund is there to help, in particular, developing countries better finance and manage their targets towards these biodiversity goals. And they've followed through with the setup of that, and it's receiving a lot of positive press. I mean, you can say whatever you want in a press release, can't you? So forgive me for sounding a bit cynical, but GEF does have a pretty good track record of creating and following through with various funding programs. So I'm quietly excited about that one. Something else that, I mean, we've spoken about it, I don't know how many times, was the sanctity of rhino horn stockpiles in South Africa. Mm. And Shan, you and I heard about this basically the night it happened, was that in South Africa's Northwest province, at the Northwest Parks Board offices, miraculously cameras were turned off, miraculously keys were left accessible, and 51 rhino horn were stolen out of the stockpile. And it took 8 hours for the police to be informed and for them to get there.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? Just
I don't want to spend too much time on it because it's just, I struggle to be surprised by these things anymore. You know, it is just so obvious the level of involvement of inside personnel on things like this, and I mean, we've been speaking about it for I don't know how long. And this isn't the first time. It's not going to be the last time. And I just encourage everybody again that when you're looking at stats or you're reading the statements of reductions and in poaching and the decline in poaching, do not confuse that with a decline in trade. And this goes a very long way to making my point. If those were 51 rhino horn stolen, so effectively I'll round it up, 26 rhino, the equivalent, if they were being poached, that's the number that would have died to produce those horns. We don't know how many of them were trimmed horns, how many of them were natural mortalities, no real insight on that. But
But it might be 26 that actually did die, you know,
sorry
through poaching.
Yeah, I mean, it could well have been. It could well have been. There could have been 26, poaching deaths where rhino horns have been recovered, seizures. We just don't have a line of sight over the breakdown of that. But the point is, a secure location within the provincial authority's office was compromised and was raided successfully.
Well, I mean, the break-in was described as a well-planned operation executed with military precision and bore the hallmark of an inside job. That's in the article. But on a positive note here, is that earlier today, or maybe it was late yesterday, a second arrest has been made by the Hawks.
Correct.
And they had a big planned operation, and they've picked up this other person who was apprehended near Brits yesterday. It was late yesterday, 9 p.m. on Tuesday evening. So let's hope that one of those suspects is high up in the organization, and they've got one of the top guys, rather than just one of the foot soldiers again.
Yeah, I mean, let's hope. Let's see what the Hawks can deliver on this. But if I just look at that 8-hour response time, you know, if you've got that level of precision, within 8 hours, those horns could have been out of could well have been on their way out of the country. And we've got mechanisms in place that can facilitate sort of the virtual shutdown of key exit points like O.R. Tambo, Johannesburg's primary international airport. We've got ways of intercepting the movement of that contraband, but timing is everything. So if you're not operating within that sort of ubiquitous golden hour, you're behind the eight ball immediately. And those things just drive me around the bend. But then on the other side, you've got the Shan, your old home, New York, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, DEC. And we knew that there was this, what was it called? Operation White Gold, which was a crackdown that was built up over several years, I think 2015 to 2018. And it focused on all sort of the high-end antique dealers, wholesale distributors, etc. Anyway, that full seizure has now gone full loop. And nearly 20 corporations and 25 people were charged with over, what was it, $12 million worth of illegal elephant ivory, which was seized in New York State. And that seizure is actually on display, would you believe?
Mm. Yeah, that part I'm not excited about, to be honest.
Yeah, I was actually wanted to push that to you, Shan, because you and I have spoken about this quite a bit. You know, when you seize it, I mean, you were at that massive ivory burn.
It was a crush in Times Square.
Sorry, that's right. Crush.
And it was around 2015, so that's probably when this whole thing started. And what we were told, because everyone asked, "Okay, you're crushing it, but it still exists. What are you going to do with it?" And at the time, the answer was, we don't know. We are considering spreading it out and giving little bits of it to schools all over the country so that they can talk to the kids about it and show it and try to teach. And I don't know. I think it should be completely destroyed like they did with the burn, because
yeah.
All you're doing is putting people in danger when you have that. And, you know, these that you're talking about now went into a museum.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know there are museums that display negative things in our past so we don't forget, but I don't think that's what this kind of museum is. And the connotation of putting something like this in a museum is usually to put it on display because it's a good thing. And I get that they want to teach it's bad, but it puts a target on their back for one. And two, I think it's better to have it destroyed and you could still have a big write-up. You could have something fake that can represent it, but I don't think it should be something that's on display like this. I just don't agree with it.
I think I agree with you. I see the value in using it from an education perspective and a public awareness perspective. I understand that sort of intellectually I can get my head around it, but whenever you show a rhino horn or you show a tusk or an ivory carving, which constitutes a lot of the seizures within this $12 million haul, the first question is that you're always looking at something that is impressive, you know, the rhino horn, the tusk, the carvings, etc. And the immediate thing next to that, as they did, as almost every news agency that's carried this, says at the top, $12 million, and then they show it's still intact. So they're saying, here it is, and it's got extraordinary value.
Yeah.
And And that talks to your point of putting a target on them. But it also says this has got incredible value if you can keep it in this form. Whereas the moment you burn it, crush it, destroy it, it doesn't have value anymore.
Well, and, crushing it, they could still have value. So I'd be careful with the crushing because a lot of things, when you send them overseas, they do get crushed. They get crushed into powders and whatever else they're doing with them. I mean, usually that's for rhino horn, but still, like, the value is still there for them and they will find a way to make money on it. So it still exists.
Yeah, I agree. I know, bring on the barrage, but I'm a big fan, and I know you are, Shan, as well, is for destroying these stockpiles like Kenya did and reduce its value and say these things are not, they do not hold value. And even if they did, it doesn't matter because the greatest value is a living animal and a thriving ecosystem where everybody, communities, governments, the entire country is focused on the protection and the value of these living animals and ecosystems. And Kenya have done that. Yes, it's not perfect. Nothing is. But Kenya, in my opinion, have done an extraordinary job of saying we're not going to reduce all of the challenges in the protection of wildlife and wild places, but we are going to make a statement that we will not trade. We are closed for business in that regard, so much so that we don't care for its value. We're going to destroy it. And since those interventions at a government level, poaching is negligible compared to Southern Africa. And so these principled stances, if you make them and you stick to them, you start focusing on the solutions and you can get on with the job at hand. And so many other countries are still debating whether any of that should happen, whether who holds the value, trade this, sell that, whatever it is. And we consistently being hit by this poaching pandemic that is just, you know, it's slowing down, but the trade sure as hell is not. So
because their message comes from government. It comes from the top. And a lot of other countries, the top is either corrupt or they don't know what message to put out there.
Right.
And I think you have to be definitive in your message and stand by it and have integrity. And I can guarantee you're going to get responses from people saying, well, you know, if it's 25 million in value, wouldn't it be better to sell that and put 25 million toward conservation? Because that's always their argument. And then people will email you about this and try to give you the same argument now.
Yeah. And for the record, to anybody that wants to do that, by all means, please reach out, but bring a new dimension to that argument. It's getting a little stale.
I agree with you entirely, Shan. And to Simon, you said you were taken to task last week about certain issues around the vicuna trade or non-trade, and expect the same this week.
And guys, I mean, that was our whole point with this podcast, was to say, you know, we've cited examples where, as an example, the Cabela Family Foundation, huge bass fishing empire in the US, resulted in a very, very wealthy family that have put a huge amount of money, and they're huge trophy hunters, and they've put a huge amount of money into conservation. So there are moments where we have to agree that there is money from certain activities going to the things that we care about. But that is not sufficient to say that the entire industry is good. Similarly, where we focus our attention on is this non-consumptive sort of, not this this living utilization of wildlife and wild places in terms of safaris, carbon markets, etc. You know, that is not without its flaws either. So, you know, when we set out with this podcast was to say, yes, we're going to take a very principled view, but we're not going to be ignorant to counter arguments that allow for us to disagree with respect. in both directions. You know, we need to find a place where we can have tough conversations about things that are working and are not working. And, you know, like I spoke about before with the idea of deontology versus consequentialism, you know, this idea that the ends justify the means. We are the people that say that's not true. How we do this is as important as the result. And, you know, in there lies wonderful opportunity for debate. And I encourage it. So if people disagree with me, bring it on. The only time that I shut people down is when you bring those ridiculous ad hominem bullshit attacks. And I'm not interested in that, and I will never, ever rise to that. I will never lower myself to that bullshit, because it's a pointless exercise and use of anybody's time. But if somebody wants to, you know, if people want to have a comment about the vicuna and they want to challenge certain things that we say or talk about, bring it on. Let's talk about it. That's the whole bloody point of the podcast. So, yeah, you know, let's share, let's talk. But I think that there is one thing that happened recently that just absolutely bloody broke my heart. And it obviously cuts deep for you and me, Peter, on a family level to see this happen. But I don't know if you guys saw, National Geographic lays off its last remaining staff writers.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand why, though.
So, well, it's business, isn't it? So it's Disney has an expectation of profit. They have an expectation of cost versus reward. And this incredibly capital-intensive stance that National Geographic has successfully done for, 130-plus years, 135 years, of taking the best writers and best photographers from around the world and sending them on assignment to capture the world and to write beautifully, deep editorial pieces on culture, wildlife, climate, ecology, everything, the universe at large has been reduced. And I just don't get it. You know, the National Geographic Society, it was always a foundation of sorts. And this is the onslaught, in my opinion, of business. And I think Disney have made an extraordinarily shit judgment call on this. Because the entire credibility of the National Geographic brand was the yellow border. Its credibility lies in what was written, not what was necessarily just filmed. Yes, that is an extraordinary component to their brand, and it's grown in leaps and bounds, and it fits into the broadcast business model. It fits into everything that they stand for. But the idea that you would systematically erode your credible base by cutting all of those writers, that editorial team down, I cannot get my head around it. You know, there was a bunch of people that were laid off after the ownership change in 2015. And systematically, they've just reduced the number of people. And I cannot get my head around it. I just can't. You know, and they talk about dwindling numbers in subscribers. And yes, those subscriber numbers have fallen, but find another delivery mechanism. Digital. I don't know. Maybe some of these writers are going to end up being researchers in the productions. I don't know. That doesn't seem to be clear. They say that it's cost cutting of staff, of editorial staff, and that they will still commission people, contract people, to come in and do it. But I don't know, man. I think they are reduced to people
pitching their stories and having them accepted. Yeah, look, I think the thing is that we've all looked up to National Geographic as not only a national American treasure, but a global treasure, because it certainly has been that. It's brought the most amazing features, the films, the books, so on and so forth. It represents an extraordinary cultural achievement, and I know it's had its criticisms, some of them valid, of course, in the way they've operated and the things that they've done and how they've approached them. But that said, it is an astounding cultural achievement, and that's what is at risk at the moment, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And as you say, it's at the mercy of a boardroom decision where somebody says, "Oh, it's not making the GP that it should. This is down, getting far too expensive. Sack the bloody editors. Sack everybody that's creative that has created this thing. And you know, we'll see if it floats. If it doesn't float, well, you know, who cares?"
Yeah.
You think it's a chance for someone to come in and perhaps buy the magazine, take over?
Give me a person, I'll do it for you.
And I'll be honest, I think there are very, very few people that have the credibility and experience to do it other than you.
Yeah, well. Yeah. You know, everyone jokes and smiles about these things, but yeah, it is a very, very sad event.
It really is. I mean, I remember growing up, there was the biggest influences on my love of the natural world was obviously being and still being your son, and growing up and seeing the birth and the growth and the workings, and privileged to work on it myself in Africa Geographic magazine, that still to this day is missed, you know. And as extraordinary as that was, it was never the size of the reach that National Geographic enjoyed for over a century. And yet it still felt. Can you imagine the void that this will leave? But I remember that was an influence. It was you were the influence, Africa Geographic. National Geographic, Attenborough, you know, and reading things like Born Free. Those were the books, those were the pages that you caressed every time you turned the page. You would almost like stroke the page, hungry to take in what was coming next. It was so profoundly influential on so many people, and to have those bastions of credible influence, you know, just being lost over time through very legitimate and understood reasons, you know, we get all of that. But I feel desperately for young people who don't have anything tactile to help them fall in love with the natural world. Africa Geographic, National Geographic, they were tactile. You were somehow touching the content when you held those pages in your hand. You're just not going to get that same feeling with the remote. You're not going to get that same deep dive. And yeah. I've always said this as well about, like, you know, Attenborough and BBC and these extraordinary documentaries and stuff that we all love, and I'm certainly not dissing them, but they are unattainable. You will almost never have those experiences in the wild. You will never have that up close, that close an experience, or that perfectly lit experience in the bush yourself on safari or diving or whatever it might be. But, you know, that fleeting on the screen or that movement on the screen, you could reference when it was in your hand. And I just think it is so sad for that to be lost. It really breaks my heart. And I know that they're going to carry on publishing, and I know that they're going to do things differently, and we'll still see a yellow border. I get all of that, but it's the trajectory that I'm talking to, and it's the loss. It's the depletion of inspiration, of tactile inspiration in that trajectory that I find really, really sad.
Yeah, well, I agree with you, but I'm not going to elaborate on it because I know that I shall embarrass myself. It gets too close and too emotional.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, what I do like, and Shan, this talks to so much of what, you know, what you are doing and what, you know, what we're trying to do with telling Munu's story and the docu-series that we've been busting our asses to put together, is that there is a world of storytellers out there that are incredibly and beautifully accessible and can take people on these learning journeys. And I hope that Disney, as this mega parent company, sees the opportunity to find those stories that are accessible and to give them voice and to give those storytellers voice. It's absolute power opportunity, in my opinion. And I really hope that they find a way to do that.
Yes, I do too. I shall have a little sip of my scotch that's sitting next to me.
Yeah, I think I might pour one as well. But I
sense that we're getting close to the end of this week's podcast.
Yes, no, we are on time.
I just wanted to share something with you because I came across it the other day, and I follow Dr. Will Folds on Twitter. And I think he often comes up with some lovely statements. And one that really struck home with me, and I know it will with you too as well, having you witnessed far more than me the dehorning of rhinos. And, you know, we know how emotional that is and the effect it has on you. You can think of it intellectually and all the reasons, and it seems fine. You get there and you watch it happening, and it's a punch in the gut. And he put it like this. He said, part barbarity, part act of love. It's a bit like watching someone you care for going through an amputation. You know it's for the best, but that doesn't make it any easier to watch. And I thought, wow, yeah, he's got it in one there.
Yeah, he does. He does. And that, I mean, I just think on every vet that I've ever done a dehorning with, and Shan, I'm sure you'll back me up on this, and there are some of them, like Dr. Mike Toft up in KZN, who has done literally thousands of dehornings, is emotional every time. It does feel barbaric. I think Will is right. I think that's the right word. You do feel like you are conducting something that is barbaric, that you shouldn't be doing it.
But
do it we must.
Do it we must in certain circumstances, absolutely.
Yeah, but, sure. Heady stuff, man. Heady stuff. And well, to everybody listening, please continue to send through your comments and your questions. We embrace every opinion that is congruent with ours, and similarly, we embrace everyone that isn't, and we want to talk about them fairly and openly. So please send them through. And also, let me use your name, especially if you don't agree with me. Let's talk. Let's talk it out. But way to get hold of us, reach out to us on social media. You can also email us at info@artofconservation.com. And please leave a review and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. It definitely does help us. And we look forward to chatting again soon. And let's hope that we have some really, really good stuff to talk about next time. God knows, I think the three of us need a happy episode from start to finish.
Indeed.
But thanks for listening, and we'll chat again soon. Take care.
We must rethink our relationship with wildlife, the environment, and each other. Join us as we uncover the innovative, unifying, and urgent solutions we need to protect the planet from ourselves. This is the Art of Conservation.